Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the SOMTV podcast. My name is Jason Wise. Honored to have you with me today. On today's podcast, I'm going to speak with Harvard professor for the history of science, Stephen Shapin. He has written several books and is a deep thinker about the way we have talked about wine throughout history and the way wine has sort of shaped our opinion of things like luxury. And there's a lot of conversations about the bullshit and how to strip that away from wine. So I'm really looking forward to that. Before I get to my conversation with Stephen Shapin, I want to tell you, we have a brand new episode of Behind the Glass playing on SOMTV right now, featuring the winemakers and the team at Lytle Barnett and Obane Wine up in the Willamette Valley in Oregon. We also have a brand new Closer Look documentary, The Wines of Argentina. Beautiful stuff. I'm really, really happy these are finally done and out there on the platform. And of course, Cup of Salvation and all of the bonus features, hours of additional content are playing right now on SOMTV. So go to SOMTV.com to subscribe and watch that and hundreds of hours of other content. So without further ado, my conversation with Professor of History of Science at Harvard University, Stephen Shapin. Stephen, it's an honor to have a conversation with you about wine. I want to start this off with, you know, there's a lot of BS in wine, and how do you cut through it? We're going to talk about history and your opinion about kind of how wine shaped us, but how do you start with the BS that's wrapped around wine, and how do you cut through that and see through it and still love wine?
Wine makes people nervous. It didn't always make people nervous, but it makes people nervous now. They don't know what they're supposed to taste. They don't know how they're supposed to recognize quality. They're ill at ease on many occasions. So one thing that people try to learn to do is to talk about wine as wine is supposed to be talked about. And that varies. The way that we talk about wine is really fairly recent. We talk about wine in terms of complicated flavor components, green apples, whetstones, tomato skin, peach kernel, things of that sort. And the mastery of this way of talking about wine is difficult. And we don't really know how much of it is bullshit and how much of it is genuine connoisseurship. When people know what they're talking about and when people are making it up, when they're trying to tell you what wine tastes like to them, and when they're trying to mystify and make you feel bad. And that's the problem that we really face as consumers of wine at present.
It's great having a historian on the podcast. So I'm going to ask you some geeky history questions here. Has it always been like this, the way we sort of perceive wine? I mean, how has our perception of wine changed throughout history and through time?
You can go back a very long way, and I don't think you want to go back this far, but in classical philosophy, you describe wine, which is a normal food, like other foods, in terms of the qualities of hot, cold, moist, and dry. There's a very limited vocabulary of tastes, mild, austere, sweet, sharp, things of that sort. That sort of vocabulary was fairly standard. It depends on who the people are. In naturally wine-drinking countries, and we're talking in European settings of the Mediterranean, wine is an ordinary beverage, whether you had it watered or not watered. So for a vast number of people who drank wine in traditional winemaking cultures, it is the substance that can inebriate you. So it's an ecstatic beverage. It has got religious significance. Wine is Christ's blood, after all. It's part of the sacraments. So wine is a special kind of food. You could say bread is a special kind of food, too. So it's a normal thing that people consume, but it's marked out historically, going back forever, because it's the thing that takes you out of yourself, that makes you drunk, that's ecstatic. And it also has religious. So it's a change of mind, a change of state. It's spiritual. Is this wine the thing that it purports to be? Is it authentic? Is it adulterated? Is it the genuine article? Now, the surprising thing for us in the late 20th and 21st century, despite the fact that we can all talk about wine scandals, is wine overwhelmingly is the thing it purports to be. We have very little wine which is no good, in a sense of obviously badly made. We have corked wines, as we know. We have a tsunami of good wine in our culture. So this whole language of is the wine adulterated, is it authentic, is the thing it's supposed to be, is largely irrelevant to us. And I know we can all think of exceptions of that. So we take for granted when the wine reaches the supermarket or the specialty wine shop or the restaurant wine list, although it may be corked, although it may be oxidized, the overwhelming wine, it is the thing it purports to be. So that way of talking about wine, which is really important from antiquity through 17th, 18th into the 19th century, has really largely disappeared. Is it the thing it's supposed to be? If you get into a period that you really might recognize as a snobbish period, let's say the Victorian, Edwardian, late 19th, early 20th century, you got a very literary style of talking about wine. Again, wine is a special beverage. It's like drinking stars. It's something which is worth attention. It's something which is complicated. It's something which absorbs your sensitivity. So snobbishness becomes a feature of this high-toned, what does the wine make me feel like? What does it evoke in me?
Well, going back to your comment on, you know, the sacrament and wine being the blood of Christ, why was wine chosen? Why not some other beverage? What's the point in fermented grape juice being that representation?
Why can you not toast people in apple juice? It's a spiritual beverage. It's with literally spirit in the sense that it's alcoholic. It's ecstatic in the sense it has the potential taken in excess to take you out of yourself, which is a quasi-religious experience. Its spiritual components go up, so it's a sacrificial offering. You could say that beer or whiskey perform that function in other cultures. But I think the reason why wine is a marked out special beverage has to do at the end of the day with the fact that it is spirituous, and that it has the potential to take human beings out of themselves. Is that the reason why it becomes a sacrament? Probably. So the idea that if people thought about wine, thought about the experience of wine, thought about what wine does to them, that it's something that you attend to in the way that you don't attend to a bowl of oatmeal, for example.
I think it depends on the oatmeal. Well, as a historian, speaking of, you know, learning about wine and learning how to communicate about wine, you know, has wine always sort of been what it is now? I mean, I would assume that the technologies and all sorts of different things have changed the way wine actually is. And then, of course, you have trends that come in. I mean, historically, how is the chemical properties of what wine used to be and the trends and all of that sort of changed our perception of wine?
I know, although I'm a creature of the culture and I know to the extent that I can how to talk the talk, I know that people haven't always talked like this. So I know there are other ways available in the past. I know there are actually other ways available in the present to talk, to appreciate wine and talk about wine. For example, to say this is a typical Volnay is an entirely intelligible thing to do. And people with exquisite sensitivities talk that way. I remember distinctly, again, in Piemonte, saying to a winemaker who'd open up an exquisite bottle of his Barolo, I said, the lovely earthy truffles. And he said, typical. Typical of the vintage, typical of this place. And I was very impressed by that. He was capable. No, he had a brother who did the marketing in Belgium and the Netherlands and Scandinavia and the U.S. And the language in which he then described the wine, the language of the back label, for example, or of the shelf talker, is violets, truffles, raspberries, baked earth. So in other words, these are almost different languages or vocabularies. The language of whetstones and tomato skins and roasted lilacs is, again, as an historian, a fairly recent one. I think this has got a lot to do with a number of things, but it has a lot to do with the development of flavor chemistry. So that from the late 50s onward, we were available through scientific techniques to detect odoriferous components in wine in very low concentrations. When you're talking about acidity, when you're talking about malic acid, when you're talking about tartrates, when you're talking about tannin, when you're talking about sugar, you're talking about components which are in wine in fairly high concentrations. But when you're talking about flavor components, like the flavor component that makes Cabernet Sauvignon or Sauvignon have a green pepper aroma, you're talking about components that the nose detects in very low concentrations and that are present in very low amounts in a glass of wine. So new science is part of the story. So that's one reason, I think, why we began to talk that way. And enologists produce books at University of California, Davis, and at Bordeaux, thinking that we should perhaps talk about wine in terms of the compounds which are really in it, and not this is a naive domestic Burgundy. And I think this appealed especially to Anglophone wine drinkers because it had, although it seems very affected and precious to talk about whetstones and roasted lilacs, you're not talking about something as masculine or feminine or having breeding or not. You're talking about something which may, under certain circumstances, actually be a sensory experience that can be traced to a specific compound which is in the wine. And I think that's, in a funny way, a democratizing impulse. So you can say, what's really in the glass? And if you talk about components that have a definable chemical component, which is a kind of dream of some enologists and flavor chemists from the latter part of the 20th century, you're cutting out the bullshit. And I think this appealed very much. And also to people like Americans and Brits and, you know, some people that don't come from traditional wine, where you couldn't say it's a typical Volnay, because what's a Volnay like? Where you say this wine has notes of violets and raspberries and red fruits. And you know there are these kits where people can have reference samples of the aromatic components to compare with the specific grape varietal or type of wine. So there's a science-y component to it, and there's a democratizing component to it, and there's a component that I can now tell you what the wine is like in a non-mystifying language. These are the aggregated organoleptic experiences that you might have in this wine. So it's a curious world that we live in, where this language that we now use to describe wine seems really affected and really precious and a kind of model of bullshit. But I think the inspiration for it is the opposite of bullshit. It's the opposite of saying, I'm drinking stars or this wine reminds me of a Browning poem. It's a way of talking about what's really in the glass. It's run amok. It's gone out of control. But I think the impulse behind it, and we began, I think, to talk this way really in both Britain and America from about the 1970s, and especially books on how to taste wine for consumers date from around that period of time. And this is how we learned to talk about wine.
So speaking of like learning to talk about wine and learning what we drink and why we like what we drink, I want to talk about wine trends. So as a historian, can you talk about how trends have sort of changed and driven what we drink and how we think about wine, what we like to drink?
Here's an obvious one. There are two characteristics we are pretty confident used to characterize wine, say, in the 19th century and even further back. Number one, it's pretty obvious that many wines were oxidized. The invention of the bottle and cork is a fairly recent one. Wines were exposed to air. So if you happen to like Pinot Sherry, my idea is what a red Bordeaux tasted like in the 17th century, you would have something of that oxidized character, which you can like or not like. That's number one. Number two, the taste for sweet wines was much more prominent in the past, even the fairly recent past it is now. Now people who are made nervous by wine or don't really know the names of wine, they're like, so I don't like sweet wine, at least I have something dry. And the fact of the matter is, presented with a wine which is high in residual sugar compared to wine which is low in residual sugar, they'll probably like the one which is high in residual sugar. But this obvious thing is the wine sweet or not sweet? It's not completely transparent to people. So it's very fashionable now to say, I don't like sweet wine, is a way of saying, I'm a grown-up. Kiddies like sweet things. I'm not a kiddie. When I was a kid, I used to like, you know, Blue Nun or Black Tower or Spanish Sweet Sauternes, as indeed I did. And so part of the fashion is dry. Even if wines are not actually dry, even if there's a good degree of residual sugar, and then people will say they like dry wines. Well, wine is labeled sweet. It's a very difficult wine to sell, with some notable exceptions. So that's a big tidal pattern. In a way, people always liked good wine, but one of the interesting things about the recognition of quality as opposed to authenticity and purity is, for example, the great classification of Bordeaux, which took place in 1855, first growth, second growth, third growth, and so on. It was based on the market prices of wines over the past 40 years or so. So in other words, so the market recognized what was good because it paid more for those wines. And then the idea that wine was first growth or second growth became a mark of quality, independent of what it cost, though such wines remain expensive.
So about the 1855 classification in Bordeaux, it was more expensive because it was a better quality, or its cost made people think it was better? I mean, is this perception or actual?
Who knows? If you're an economist, you'd probably say it was better, and the proof of it is people are willing to pay more for it. But the economists have this notion called the Giffen good, and that is goods that will sell less if you reduce the price. So many luxury goods are like that. And so one way that we, independent of what critics write or independent of the numbers that critics may assign to the quality of wine, one way that we have, and unfortunately very difficult to set aside, is our knowledge of how much a wine cost, which may simply be a way of saying, and it may be better in the sense that if I know that I'm being given a very expensive wine, I'm going to pay attention to it. Like if I know that in a museum, and this is a very famous painting, I will pay attention to it. And maybe the wines or the paintings that you pay attention to are wines that you actually appreciate more. So the idea that you can independently sort out what we know about the goodness of a wine as opposed to our experience of its actual goodness, I think is problematic. We know a lot about wines, and unless we're doing blind tasting, truly blind tasting, we know a lot about wines, and that orientates us in a way you can't say that that's wrong necessarily, because if you're naturally drinking wine in a natural setting, you're drinking a wine that you know something about, that you have expectations about with people, with the food that you've chosen. So all of that context, which, as it were, professional wine critics and writers may try to set aside to tell you what the wine is really like, is, to use a fancy term, decontextualizing the experience of drinking wine. But as we naturally drink wine, as consumers, we drink wine in a context, and that context may include what we know about the wine, what our expectations are. If we're given a glass of Barolo, we have a set expectations of what a Barolo is like. And that's one reason that a lot of wine writers and critics don't like to do blind tasting. They like to do verticals, they like to do horizontals, but they don't like to do completely blind ones because there they have no set of expectations to orientate them. But for people like me, or many wine consumers, context is not a bad thing. It's a normal thing. And it may add to the enjoyment of wine. You know, having a glass of Barolo with the winemakers on a terrazzo in Castiglione Folletto is a pleasurable experience. It gives you a setting. You know something about this is where the wine came from. These are the people that made it. This is the food that it goes with. Is that a bad thing? Not necessarily. There is some reason why wines are expensive. There's some reason why wines are cheap, but the relationship between dollar value and the pleasure that it gives you, and especially the pleasure it gives you now, is deeply problematic. Supply and demand is part of it. I really don't know what to say. I'm made very happy when I get wine that gives me an enormous amount of pleasure. I mean, I go into wine shops, I go for the bin ends. Right. And it's exciting. Right. I just go and look at, you know, as long as the bottles look sound, I want to pay as little as possible. But how much have I paid for wine? A lot. You know, price is no object as long as what I'm nervous of doing, and I think a lot of wine consumers are nervous of doing, is paying a lot of money for wine with which I have no experience. Now, I've had a taste, you know, if you're tasting in Burgundy, you have some sense, or recently that the Pinot Noir celebration in Oregon, and you see these $800 bottle of Oregon wines, and occasionally you say, you know, something that's worth every penny of it.
Right.
But I don't want to just go and buy a $100 bottle of wine and then discover I'm a mug. But I'm happy to pay $100 or more for a bottle of wine if I know that it's going to give me that kind of pleasure.
So what if I were to ask you, are you a wine expert? Obviously, you're on this podcast because you know a little bit about wine and history. But are you an expert or are you a consumer? Which one are you? What's your identity as far as a wine drinker goes?
No, I have two identities. I'm an historian. I will continue to work on the history of taste, whether it concerns wine or not concerns wine, for reasons that have to do with my academic role. I'm also a consumer. I enjoy wine. I keep these things separate, so I never tell people what I think is good unless they're friends of mine. They ask me what I've particularly enjoyed or what I'm drinking tonight. I'm perfectly happy to do that with friends, but I would never, ever appear in a public print telling people as if I have some expertise of if my taste ought to be their taste. Other people do this. Some people do it well. Some people do it badly. I read a lot of it. Some I like, some I don't like. I would simply like to have as much experience with different kinds of wine, especially wines of great quality, as some wine writers do. I'd like to know, as I now don't know, what a 59 Lafite is like. I'd like to know what Romane Conti is like, which I've never had. I'd like to have these things often enough so that I could form a photographic image of things of that goodness, prepared to come to the conclusion that my ability to appreciate them may be limited. But that's what I would like. I would like to live a lot longer and drink a lot more good wine and develop that kind of familiarity that I have with wines that I have in my cellar that I have a pretty good chance of recognizing because they're old friends.
To sort of end this and wrap things up, I want to ask you, in your opinion, as a consumer and an expert, both of those identities, what do you think is the most underrated wine region in the world?
I think probably Southern Italy. Although to say it's underrated is probably late breaking news. It's not underrated, but the pleasure that one can get, especially from the white wines of Campania, Puglia, and I think of the Vermentinos of Sardinia, I think the interest, the expression of the grape, the restraint and balance with which they're made. And then you can walk into a store and get these things for $10 to $20, and I think they give an extraordinary amount of pleasure.
And I will tell you, I love thinking about wines in your cellar as old friends. I may steal that line from you, Stephen. It's an honor to talk to you and great to have you on the podcast. And I want to thank our producer, John Adams. I want to thank all of you for listening. I hope you found this enlightening. Everybody, I want to tell you to make sure you go to SOM TV and watch the new Behind the Glass episode on Lytle Barnett, Obey and Wines. I want you to go and see the closer look at Argentina, where we filmed in Mendoza and all over that country. It's a beautiful, beautiful episode streaming right now. And go to SOMTV.com. You can watch that and so much more, including Cup of Salvation, our new film, and all the things we have coming. All right, everybody, please be safe and enjoy a glass of wine from Southern Italy for me. All right, take care.